Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's welcome now our South Dakota Public Broadcasting journalists to the program as we look at news from the South Dakota State Legislative Session. Joining us from the Capitol Building and Pier, we have Lee Strubinger. Hey, Lee.
Hi, Lori.
Jackie Hendry is with us in the SDPB Sioux Falls studio here in the Kirby Family Studio. Hey, Jackie.
Hey, Lori.
Stephanie Rissler joins us from SDPB Studios in Vermilion on the campus of USD. Hi, Steph.
Hello.
And Seth Tupper is with us from Rapid City in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio. Seth, hi.
Hi, Lori.
We're going to start with Lee Strubinger in the Capitol building now. Lee, what are you watching this week?
I'm keeping a real close eye on Senate Bill 157, which is Governor Kristi Noem's bill that tinkers with the county zoning and appeal process. Noem says it's designed to cut red tape and improve the process.
All right. How would it do that?
Sure. So let's first take a look at the appeals process the bill addresses. So if a project that requires a conditional use permit, like a wind farm or a concentrated animal feeding operation, also called a CAFO, gets approved and concerned citizens want to appeal that decision, they have to make that decision within 14 days of an approved project. Mm-hmm. The bill further defines who those people making an appeal can be, and it encourages the court to expedite that hearing process. An appeal petition must be for a writ of certiorari, which is a review by the courts that checks whether a process was followed or not. And it doesn't consider other things. It just takes a look at process. So there's your, I guess, law lesson for the day.
Sure.
The bill requires a bond for those who want to bring an appeal, and it allows judges to award court costs and damages against those who bring an appeal if they lose. And the governor's office says this is meant to be a deterrent against frivolous appeals, what they call frivolous appeals.
All right, there's a lot to this story. What else does the bill do?
Sure. So there's other parts of the bill that reduces the requirement some counties have when voting on a conditional use permit. So it moves that down to a simple majority of members present. And that will impact some counties that have a two-thirds majority requirement in place when voting on conditional use permits. It also further clarifies a type of process called a special permitted use.
Explain.
Sure. It's a process for certifying conditional uses that meet specified criteria, and that's the language of the state law. So this was established in 2015 by then Republican Representative Mark Mickelson, and it allows counties to establish a zoning ordinance process that basically rubber stamps projects that meet county and state requirements. Noem's bill takes it a little bit further and says projects that fall under special permitted use aren't subject to public hearings. And when I spoke to the governor's office about special use permitting, they say that this is not something, this is something that counties can choose to use. It is not something that is mandatory.
All right, Lee. So this is a lot of legal information sort of packed into, but there's some big questions. And the reason that this has been newsworthy is it largely because of some of the controversy in counties about CAFOs and how those get approved and how some citizens are coming out in protest of those in their neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. And the bill, as I just described it, was basically all just procedural at this point. It's going to get heard tomorrow morning in Senate State Affairs, and I'm assuming that some of that testimony from concerned citizens will come up in due time. But this could change a lot of the process for contentious county hearings over those projects.
Yeah, and the governor has come out and said this is about streamlining things, making it easier to do business in South Dakota. So Senate Bill 157, yeah, Definitely something to be looking forward to this week, more information on. Lee, another bill you reported on last week creates a penalty for texting and driving. Seems like we've heard that before, yeah?
Yeah, it was brought again this year by Republican Representative Doug Barthel. He's the former Sioux Falls police chief. And he says this is a bill that is long overdue. Texting and driving is a secondary offense in state law currently, which means you can get ticketed for it, but an officer must pull you over for other reasons than just that. And Barthel says with the proliferation of social media on phones, you know, on smartphones, it's made driving even more distracting. And he says hands-free technology in cars is making it easier for people to communicate while they're driving, so they don't have to text and drive. This was a bill that died last year after making it out of the House and onto the Senate floor. It got held up on a tie vote and then was reconsidered 2 days later when it ultimately failed. When I spoke with Barthel after that vote last year, you know, he said he wasn't going to bring it again. However, some families reached out to him over the summer.
Their son was killed a few years ago, and he rear-ended a semi-truck, didn't even touch the brake. They were able to review his phone and found out that he was taking pictures right before the crash. So once I heard that story, it was tough to say no, and so I decided to bring the bill back again this year.
Barthel says by making texting and driving a primary offense, the goal is for voluntary compliance. He says the goal is not for jurisdictions to get rich off of writing tickets.
All right, and I understand that there's another bill from Deb Soholt talking about children and driving and keeping the roads safer as well. So lots to follow there. This next bill is 1117, and we're going to kind of tag team this one. Victoria Wicks has been reporting on this on Twitter. Stephanie has some bites on this, and so does Lee. So Lee, what I would how I'd like to run this is if you could kind of set up the past of this a little bit, this riot boosting bill, and then we're going to pass it to Stephanie for her clip. So tell us why this is coming up now and what its background is, please, Lee.
Sure. So this is a bill that rewrites Noem's riot boosting law from last session. Recall, if you will, a federal judge struck down the bill, finding it largely unconstitutional. And this new bill still includes penalties for those who incite crime. And supporters say it also protects the rights of free speech and to peaceably assemble. Governor Noem says the bill seeks to clarify statute in relation to those bills that were passed last year. The federal courts said part of her riot-boosting bill needed to be removed.
So we are doing that in this legislation and also putting new language and statute in that we believe is appropriate and will be upheld going forward. So it is protecting everyone's ability to protest peacefully. And to make sure their First Amendment rights are protected, but also make sure that those who wish to commit acts of violence, that there is consequences.
I want to bring Stephanie Rissler into the conversation now, Lee, because Stephanie, Governor Kristi Noem made it clear early this session she was going to bring this to lawmakers. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about who from the governor's office sort of came and spoke and what they had to say, please.
So last week in House State Affairs, it was brought up for the first time in the committee, and her team was there to speak to the bill. Tom Hart with the governor's office laid out what the bill will do and spoke about three different things.
It'll repeal the sections of South Dakota Code that the federal court struck down in September of 2019. It'll codify the incitement crime for the violent few who seek to infringe on others' rights while still preserving individuals' constitutional rights of free speech and peaceful assembly. And third, it'll update our riot and riot-boosting civil actions to protect everyone and their property by keeping them safe by the narrowest means necessary to only include unprotected conduct that is intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action.
I'm going to bring Lee back into the conversation in just a minute, but first, Stephanie, there are others who are speaking in favor of the bill. What did they have to say?
So lobbyist Dick Thiessen, he's representing the South Dakota Sheriff's Association, speaking in favor of it, saying it's a good plan, but really addressing the issue of violence in the bill.
It is a plan, and I think it's a good plan, should the need become necessary. I think that's pretty clear in the bill. This bill may not be necessary. I hope it isn't. Law enforcement hopes that there will be no need for our intervention. None of what's in House Bill 1117 ever comes into play unless a peaceful protest turns violent.
And Lee, what he said there is really important as he talks about a peaceful protest turning violent. Let's talk about opponents of this bill. What's one of the first things that they've pointed out?
Right. Opponents of this bill say existing criminal laws already protect individuals from those who engage in acts of violence. So this bill creates a Class 5 felony against those who might incite three or more people acting together to use force or violence to any person or damage to property. I think it's goes without saying that this legislation is really aimed at potential protests arising if the development of the KXL Keystone XL pipeline project comes through the state.
Stephanie, who spoke against that in committee?
Candy Brings Plenty is representing ACLU of South Dakota. She also talked about last year's attempt and the federal government killing that particular law. She said this is just a second attempt to do the same thing.
As you know, the original riot-boosting bill was filed last legislative season quickly, and it passed into law and was challenged in federal court by the ACLU. The court ruled in the plaintiff's favor and found the law unconstitutional, and the state quickly agreed to settle the suit. Today's bill, House Bill 1117, is a second attempt at the riot-boosting law. This attempt, like the first, is an unnecessary effort to legislate peaceful protest in South Dakota. It's undeniable that this bill, like the 2019 law it replaces, was sparked by a desire to suppress protests around the KXL pipeline.
All right, Stephanie, what happens next with this legislation?
So lawmakers passed it out of committee on a 10-3 vote. It is on the calendar today to be debated by the full House of Representatives. We'll have to see if they get to it or not, but I know our team will be listening. You can also listen to it online at sd.net.
And as we mentioned earlier, SDPB's Victoria Wicks is also following that closely and will be tweeting about it throughout the day. Lee, putting you on the spot, do you know Victoria's Twitter handle off the top of your head?
I can find it just super duper quick, actually. I have Twitter pulled up. It is at VVEE underscore Wicks, WICKS.
All right, Victoria Wicks, thank you for that. And Lee Strubinger, we're going to let you go to your next gig there. We'll take a quick break. We'll have more with Jackie Hendry, Seth Tupper, and Stephanie Rissler after that break. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's time for our weekly roundtable with SDPB journalists as we give you an update from the State House. And you can find a lot of that coverage at sdpb.org. And look under the Explore tab for politics and public policy. Many of those stories are there. And Seth Tupper is joining us from Rapid City as part of this conversation. And Seth, taxes. Let's talk taxes here. There's a little bit of legislation. And again, it's part of this broader story about things that there's just no appetite for in Pierre, but they're worth talking about because the conversation is slowly shifting. Set this one up for us, please.
Yeah, this is about the lack of taxes, severance taxes specifically on bentonite and limestone. I got interested in this several years ago when there was an application to the state to remine a formerly mined area northwest of Belle Fourche for bentonite. And it turns out that bentonite has been mined in South Dakota for decades. There's been millions of tons of the material taken out of the ground here.
All right, what's it used for?
It's used in all kinds of things, everything from the one I'm most familiar with actually is with drilling. They use it to plug holes after they do exploratory drilling. It's used in cat litter. It can be used in detergent. And if you Google bentonite uses, there's hundreds of things that it's used in, so it's a very useful item. It's processed in Wyoming, and the trains come through Rapid City on a daily basis full of bentonite. But again, never had a severance tax on it in the same way that we do have a severance tax on things like gold and silver. And severance tax means just kind of what it says. It's a tax on severing a natural resource from the ground.
I was going to ask that question. I'm so happy you answered it for me.
Not something you hear about every day in everyday conversation, obviously.
Yeah.
But so we never had that. So that came to the attention of Senator Ryan Maher, who's a Republican from Isabel. And he has a very large district. It includes the Belle Fourche area where bentonite is mined. And he brought a bill this year to implement a 2% tax on severance tax on not only bentonite, but also limestone. And he wanted to dedicate the revenue to replace the Mineral Industries building at the School of Mines and Technology here in Rapid City, which is in need of replacement. And when Senator Maher testified on the bill, here's what he had to say about how it could be used to fund that construction.
This building is probably 5 years down the pipeline, and should this bill pass, they could actually start stockpiling some of this cash because the money goes into the bond redemption fund. And lo and behold, in 5 years, you might have $10 million saved up. You wouldn't have to bond for the full $35 or $40 million that they're currently projecting that this building is going to cost.
Lo and behold. All right. So what was the response?
Well, not good, as you might guess. Senator Maher had told me that when he filed the bill, he got some calls from people in the mining industry. Several representatives of the mining industry and broader industry showed up to testify against the bill. That included Associated General Contractors, South Dakota Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the Home Builders Association, Pete Lean and Sons, which mines limestone here in Rapid City, testified against the bill. And then even the governor's office sent someone, and that was Jason Evans from the Department of Revenue, who had this to say.
It should come as no surprise that the Department of Revenue is here opposing this bill. You see, this is a new tax that would increase the tax burden upon South Dakotans. And as the governor has expressly stated many times, this is in direct conflict with her pledge to protect South Dakotans from tax increases.
All right, not a surprise at all, except still a conversation. You said, you know, Ryan Maher knows this, and he's sort of bringing these things up in peer for discussion. Tell us a little bit, Seth, about what's happening and what's the magnitude of this, and how do we judge that based on what other states are doing?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons Senator Maher brought the bill, is it turns out that other states do tax bentonite and limestone, have a severance tax on them. Bentonite, for example, in Wyoming last year, counties in Wyoming made $5.7 million in revenue from taxing both of those materials, and the state made $1.7 million. Some other neighboring states like Montana also have that tax, and so it is a potentially significant source of revenue that we just haven't tapped here in South Dakota. And one of my favorite bits of audio from the session so far came from Senator V.J. Smith from Brookings, who reflected on that during the committee hearing on this bill. And he talked about our political culture here in South Dakota when it comes to making revenue off mining as opposed to some of our neighbors like North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming. And here's a little of his testimony.
I often hear when I'm out and about how fortunate the people in Wyoming are to sit on top of all those resources. And the state is a little wealthier because of it. And then I hear about it, about eastern Montana because of the Bakken, and of course in western North Dakota. We always envy these places because there's stuff underground, and they're getting a lot of stuff because of it. And yet we would shy away from taxing because that's the South Dakota way. You know, I'm not a big fan of taxes, but eveny Christmas. You know, those people in Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota aren't apologizing for taxing the stuff they got.
Part of this, right? Eveny Christmas.
Precisely.
And it is a part of this larger conversation about who we are, what we value, and then when should we change those values a little bit based on, you know, what's coming in the future? I don't know. It's a big question, isn't it?
It is a big question. I've always wondered about that, you know, what is it about Wyoming and Montana and North Dakota, for example, that makes them willing to tax these kinds of things that South Dakota apparently isn't willing to do? And I should add, the bill did go down 5-2, and so we'll see if it's there was some discussion at the end of the hearing about this at least raised a discussion about how to fund this building at the School of Mines and how maybe the industries that benefit from hiring mines graduates should have a role in paying for it. So we'll see where that goes.
And I'm also fascinated by this when we have such a short session, Seth, and you know, much is made about our citizen legislature's term limits. Last week, Jackie Hendry had a story. We talked about Sean Bordeaux saying, I'm going to bring this back, and then I'm going to train the person who comes after me, to bring this bill back. And he was talking about a bill about racist mascots in the high schools. But Ryan Maher is kind of doing this more than once this session, saying, we're going to be talking about this 5 years from now. I'm going to bring it up now, even though I know this bill is going to fail. I think that's a fascinating narrative that's kind of appearing this session that I haven't been paying attention to in the past.
Yeah, and he seems to have adopted that this year, especially as a sort of a strategy on several things that, you know, let's get the conversation started. And he made a remark earlier in the session that these things, unpopular ideas tend to start unpopular, and you bring them back three or four times, and then you never know what can happen. So yeah. He's giving it a go.
All right, and it'll be interesting as you continue that interest in bentonite and limestone, the industries and those taxes as well. Seth, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Speaking of conversations that we've had before that are ongoing, looking into the future, how's that for a segue? Jackie Hendry is with us here talking about kindergarten age requirements, a tale of two kindergarten bills.
Yes.
So, Jackie, let's for people who don't have kids in school and aren't living this on a daily basis, what's on the books right now as far as kindergarten and how old you have to be to get there?
Right. So as it is right now, if your child is 5 years old, by September 1st, they start kindergarten that year. That's the cutoff. Even if your kid's birthday is September 2nd, too bad. You're waiting until next year to start kindergarten. That's how the law exists right now. So that brings us to our very first of these two kindergarten bills. The first bill deals with an option of starting kindergarten just a little earlier if you don't meet that cutoff. This bill came from Representative Tony Randolph, and his bill would allow for a window between that September 1st deadline and the end of the year. If your child turns 5 years old in that window, you can opt to have your child screened for developmental readiness. Those screening instruments in the bill to be approved by the Department of Education. And then depending on the results of that screening, parents can then have the option of enrolling their child in kindergarten earlier. So about giving parents that option if your kid doesn't quite make that September 1st cutoff.
All right. What's the screening look like?
And it's a key question because Secretary of Education Ben Jones testified against this bill. And he says the current law is clear and the introduction of screeners and waivers would introduce a lot more complications, and here's why.
Currently, the department doesn't have screeners. School districts choose the screeners they wish to use, and the department is not involved in that at all. So that would be a thing we'd have to work through in DOE to get that, and also to develop a process of adjudication of waivers and so forth. That brings up funding and time, manpower and time, and so forth.
So because the bill specifically points out the Department of Education as approving these screening techniques, Secretary Jones saying we're not doing that right now. This would add quite a bit more than anticipated. That was a problem to the department. Also, Representative Linda Duba speaking on her own behalf against this bill. She has teaching experience in the Sioux Falls District, and she says on top of, you know, academic readiness for kindergarten, those younger children may not be socially or emotionally ready to start going to school full time, and she says there's really no quick screener to determine that.
All right, so this brings up the broader question of, is this really about kindergarten, or is this part of this ongoing conversation and coverage that SDPB was looking at pretty intensely about early childhood education and preschool? We know there hasn't been much of an appetite to fund that in the South Dakota legislature. Mm-hmm. So is this a kindergarten question or an early childhood question?
And that question came up in committee. Interesting, as far as the history of this bill, Representative Randolph in his introduction explains, he was contacted by a parent of a child in a private school setting, and that child's fifth birthday is after the September 1st cutoff.
But both the parent and the teacher believed that the child was not only academically ready, but socially and emotionally ready. But there was no means for them to be able to do that.
So the key point there being there was a teacher, a preschool teacher, with mm-hmm. history with this child who could also speak to the academic and social readiness of this particular child. But the idea being not every child in South Dakota will necessarily have that history with an educator to also speak to their child's ability. Rob Munson of the School Administrators of South Dakota also pointed this out in his opposing testimony.
This would be a great opportunity to talk about the accessibility and affordability and rigor of early childhood education, and we'd be excited about that conversation with you. But at this point, Madam Chair and Committee, we would hope that you would resist the passage of House Bill 1157.
The House Education Committee did pass this bill through to the House floor with the idea of clearly there's a thirst for flexibility among parents in the state. However, the bill failed in the House with a 16 in favor but 47 opposed.
Which brings us to the second kindergarten start date bill on the other end of the spectrum. Explain.
So this particular bill from Representative Chase actually moves the cutoff a little earlier. So rather than a September 1st, your child would need to be 5 years old by August 1st in order to attend kindergarten. The idea being this aligns better with August start dates for school and adds a little more time for children to reach that maturity for kindergarten.
All right. How much of a difference can that time frame actually make?
According to kindergarten teachers, quite a lot. We heard from, I believe it was three kindergarten teachers in favor of this particular bill. Amy Drakey is one of those three kindergarten teachers. She tells the committee her students in her classrooms range from those who just turned five within a few weeks of school starting to those who are about to turn six. And she says there's a big difference in maturity between the older and the younger students in her classroom.
These students are unable to sit for 10 to 15 minutes or stay focused on a lesson, and they often get frustrated easily due to the fact that I cannot attend to just their needs as I have 25 to 26 other children to attend to at the same time. The younger students also have a harder time with personal space, keeping their hands to themselves, raising their hand, following the pace of a classroom.
And another teacher testified to the fact that really any date not based on ability will feel arbitrary, but this particular shift a month earlier allows students to be more mature and more likely to succeed because, as all three kindergarten educators say, and many others, kindergarten's a lot different than it was 20 years ago. You're learning more than just coloring in the lines in kindergarten now.
Right. My kindergarten report card has a piece of paper where I had to cut a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. That was a long time ago.
Yep.
It's slightly different now. All right, so what's the downside?
Well, Secretary of Education Ben Jones, again, was the only opposing testimony to this particular bill, and his concern related to how this might impact state aid to school districts by altering how many students may be enrolling at a particular time. But he also pointed out how this bill may impact families' plans this year.
It's also the way the bill is currently structured that could be problematic for many families who have an August birthday this year and have been expecting for 4.5, 5 years to send their little one off to school in the fall of 2020. And when the law, if should this pass, become effective on 1 July, now they need to rethink things.
So, of course, committee members saying kindergarten shouldn't be treated as daycare and so on. Representative Latterell on the House Education Committee agreed with Ben Jones' concerns, offered an amendment to delay the effective date for this bill. That didn't go through. So the bill passed through committee as written. If passed, it would go into effect this year. It's on the House floor agenda today, so we wait and see.
And Jackie, if you have teacher friends on Facebook, they're vocal
yes.
about this, and many do feel like it's an assault on their classrooms and that early childhood education is the way to go. And they're not afraid to say so, especially in a year when they're not guaranteed of their cost of living increase.
There you go. Yep. Right. It's a multifaceted debate.
All right, another fascinating debate. Stephanie Risler, last week, South Dakota Focus, tell us a little bit about this notion of workforce development and housing needs, because we hear about what a great idea for a show, because this is another thing that's just super complicated in South Dakota.
It is. And it was something that the governor has talked about during her State of the State address. Our state's open for business. What exactly does that mean? What are our state's workforce needs? With that is the issue of housing, and we have a housing shortage on a statewide level. So we brought together a number of folks to really lay out the facts in their own communities in terms of what are your workforce needs and what are your housing needs. We had a chat with Joe Fiala. He is the development director for the Governor's Office of Economic Development. At one time, the governor had mentioned using the Ready Loan as a possible solution for more housing. So Joe Fiala talked about what that's looking like right now.
We are entertaining an idea here this legislative session, or this time frame, where we have the Ready Fund, the Revolving Economic Development and Initiative Fund, that's traditionally been used for business loans. So we're entertaining the idea of opening that up for loans for multifamily housing. And we do have a little bit of a process that we have to go through. We have to take some public comment. Our Board of Economic Development has to craft the guidelines, specifically of how it could be used. And so we're working through that process now, but we hope to be able to, you know, by maybe middle of the year, start helping some projects move forward.
Stephanie, what kind of questions did you get from listeners? Because that's such a, I'm envious of that part of your show, and it's always fascinating to hear what people ask and why. What do you remember from that?
It is fun. A lot of folks, well, a few folks typing in wanting to know about specific plans. What are communities doing? We had a gentleman on from the Tyndall Development Corporation, and they've put together a program called Dakotaplex, and it's created a number of units, low housing units, so there can be more housing opportunities for the town of Tyndall. They've got a lot of folks that have tried to make their dreams come true and are starting their own businesses in this small community, but of course housing was an issue, so that's one of the things that folks were writing in about. What more can we see? What opportunities are going to be out there? One of the other questions that that kept coming in was low wages in South Dakota. As we look towards these workforce needs, what about paying South Dakotans a higher wage? And of course, the folks that we have on the show were more development folks representing their own communities, talking about what they're doing at that local level to help businesses. They really don't have a say in what people get paid, but they're definitely listening. They're paying attention. It was an interesting conversation, and I think it's going to be a conversation we're going to see happen more intently as the months move on.
And Seth Tupper, I think we maybe talked about this last week, and I mentioned a development project in Mitchell where Trail King is trying to find out how to have housing that workers can afford. And it's a huge Black Hills problem, too, isn't it? Affordable housing, especially as it ties into workforce development and wages.
Absolutely. And we do have, there are some, there's a nonprofit in Minnesota I know that has been active in looking at trying to do affordable housing projects out here in Rapid City and is actively engaged in that right now. Hill City has had some projects that they've done, Spearfish. So, yeah, it seems to be an never-ending problem with the high cost of living out here.
All right, let's talk about the week ahead and some things that you're paying attention to. Jackie Hendry, big stuff coming up.
Full plate, right. This afternoon, House Health and Human Services Committee will be reconvening after session to hear the introduction of a bill from Representative Schwach looking at a feasibility study for long-term care in the state. I'm interested in that one. Thursday, Senate Education will act on the Ocheti-Chacoan Community-Based Schools Bill, some amendments with that the governor's office now supports. So just a couple things to look forward to in the week ahead.
All right. Stephanie Ristler, this focus is, we just had Ellie Krug on the program earlier in hour one talking about LGBT issues and how we just, I mean, sometimes we even disagree on what compassion looks like. Tell me a little bit about this upcoming South Dakota focus.
So Thursday, we're going to take a closer look at all of the bills that have been introduced to this particular session aimed at the LGBTQ plus individuals. They're also going to take a look back at what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years. A lot of folks labeling South Dakota as a testing state for legislation that we're seeing on a national level. So we're going to introduce viewers to some faces, to some individuals, so they can speak directly about how this is impacting them, their lives, their families. We'll take a look into some of the committee hearings where this testimony took place. We'll hear from the prime sponsor of a few of these bills as they introduced it in committee. And as always, folks can share with us their own questions and comments. It's going to be, I think, a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, and one of the things that I asked Ellie Krug when she was talking with us, I just said, you know, for people who are coming at this legislation with what they say is, you know, compassion for children, for example, you know, what's your response to that? And she was very clear about these efforts are efforts to erase people from public view. And you see that in different states through model legislation and the same language, this erasure, which is still sticking with me after that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it will be a difficult conversation. We'll also have on Susan Williams. She created an organization called Transformation South Dakota, and she has a transgender child, and she has taken it upon herself to create this program that helps to educate and make folks understand what it's like, how to have that conversation, what questions to ask, and to be more compassionate.
All right, a lot ahead this week happening in Pierre and across the state. Anybody else have anything they want to jump in and say is really important to look for this week coming out of Pierre specifically? If not, we'll talk to you next time.
Keep him busy.
All right, there's a long list. Seth Tupper, Jackie Hendry, Stephanie Rissler, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks.